The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Taxi Show.
Hey, Todd here. You know, sometimes I forget to wash. For weeks at a time, my body takes on an earthy, musky smell like loamy topsoil. I'm mighty proud of my stink, because it's a man-sized stink. Can you smell me through your radio? If so, I'm sorry, but I can smell you, so we're even. And now, Eric Motaxis.
I don't understand how somebody who claims to be some kind of Christian could say such things on a program like this.
Well, that's it. He's some kind of Christian.
Albin.
Yeah.
What is he thinking? Our audience is so sophisticated and so non-smelly. There's the irony. I mean, wow.
No.
Okay, we've got, this is pretty exciting. We have Dana Lash.
Oh, yes.
A lot of people know her. If you don't know her, buckle your seatbelts. She's extraordinary. She has a new book out called Grace Canceled. Mm-hmm. It's about how, you know, everybody's at war with everyone else. You know, I was invited to a college. I'm not going to mention the name, but a number of the faculty wanted to rescind my invitation. They wrote to the people who had invited me. And I thought, we're at this point where that's just what everybody does all the time.
And it had nothing to do with your politics. They just didn't like you.
They just hate me.
Yeah.
No, but it's interesting. And so Dana has written a book. So in a couple of minutes, Dana Lash. We've got a lot of other stuff to talk about. Albin, I don't even know where to start. Last night, I want to say this. I want to say this. Before, first of all, we've got a fun fact for people. We're going to share that in a second. But I just want to say what I did last night. I didn't watch the debate. Did you?
No, I did not.
Okay. Now, if I had remembered the debate was on, the Democratic debate, I would have watched it because you want to see what's going to happen. Bernie Sanders has rocketed into the lead.
Wow.
He's like a Brezhnev-era communist.
Great.
Who wants to bring America back, you know, to the Stone Age, effectively. And he is in the lead of the Democratic
Party. If anybody wants to know whether the Russians are meddling in the 2020 election, just look at Bernie Sanders.
You know what? That's very funny. Yeah. That's exactly right. But it is kind of fascinating.
Missed it, though. The media missed that.
And this is like we're making jokes. He defended Fidel Castro. Mm-hmm. Like, ladies and gentlemen, I mean, there are young people listening to this program who don't understand. Fidel Castro is like up there with Hitler and Stalin. I mean, he put prisoners, he put political prisoners in prison for years and years and years. They were tortured. This is in Cuba under Fidel Castro. This is a wicked totalitarian regime. And you have a guy named Bernie Sanders who is easily now the front runner.
Yeah.
And he defended that, oh, well, Fidel Castro taught them to read or whatever. I mean, I can't even, I don't want to get into it, but
read
we missed it last night.
Manifesto.
And the reason Suzanne and I missed it is because, you know, we've discovered that, hey, if you don't know, if there's nothing good on Turner Classic Movies, on Netflix, on Hulu, on Amazon Prime, there are all these beautiful miniseries that the BBC made, most of them. Jane Austen's novels, Charles Dickens' novels. Dickens wrote a lot of books. Jane Austen wrote quite a number of books. And then, of course, there's George Eliot wrote Daniel Deronda. That's a phenomenal book, not as popular. But all of those Victorian era novels have been turned usually by the BBC into some kind of a miniseries.
Yeah.
And almost all of them are spectacular.
Oh, yeah.
And didn't you say you just watched one?
Yeah, you were watching Charles Dickens' last novel yesterday.
The last novel is called, last night we watched the last three episodes of Our Mutual Friend. It's Dickens' last novel. It's not as well known, but I'll tell you, it's amazing.
Well,
and it's all about money. It's kind of amazing, but it's a six-part series, and It's just brilliant. So we watched that last night.
And Ann and I were rewatching something we saw a couple years ago, Bleak House with Gillian Anderson. That's the better one of the Bleak Houses that we've seen. Bleak House 2005. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
The sets, the costumes. Shake me up, Judy. There's a guy named Phil Davis playing.
Right. Suzanne and I just watched that a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And when you say Shake Me Up, Judy, that is so funny because I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah.
They're characters. We don't want to spoil it for people, but Dickens, of course, doesn't get much better than Dickens or Jane Austen, and they wrote so many novels. And so it's kind of a funny thing that when we complain about what's available, you can go on any of these streaming services, and you know, if you go in the search engine and just type in Dickens or Austen, A-U-S-T-E-N, all these great things will come up. And I have to say, they're quite wonderful. And I recommend them. That's what we did last night. Instead of watching Bernie he was taking incoming from all of the quote unquote moderates. The moderates now are like Venezuelan leftists, and he's a hardcore Moscow leftist. It's actually hilarious. And Biden, of course, famously recently said that I'm running for the U.S. Senate. Mm-hmm. You should give me a chance. It's I guess let me say this. I sort of predicted all of this months ago. The only place I went wrong was in my ultimate conclusion. But what I said was that, look, this is inevitable. They all want to be president. They can play patty cake for a while, but at some point it's going to come down to the wire. They all want to win. They're going to have to attack each other.
Yeah.
And so what they're going to do is whoever's the front runner, they're going to attack the front runner. So the other day, Bloomberg is out there like, oh, no, you don't, pal. And they attack him like crazy. Then Bernie wins Nevada.
Yeah.
And by the way, I told you he vowed today, Nevada, and tomorrow onward to Moscow. He said that.
Great.
But the point is that you know they're going to attack the front runner. So last night they attacked, big surprise, Bernie Sanders. But whoever is in the lead, whoever is challenging them, they're going to attack them. So it's interesting because that's not a good strategy for the general election, that you're going to have a very bloodied candidate who was attacked by his Democratic confreres, you know, and it's all on tape and everything. So the whole thing.
Or Democratic comrades.
Or comrades, right. Anyway, okay, now we've got a fact for the day. Albin, I have to thank you for this.
Yeah.
In 19th, we're going to try doing this more often, folks, give you a fact for this day in history. In 1935, a man named Robert Watson Watt demonstrated, and we don't even know if somebody says, who invented radar? Nobody knows. Robert Watson Watt demonstrated his radar, R-A-D-A-R. Does anybody know what radar stands for? I confess I did not.
Mm.
I confess I had never heard what radar stands for. Had you known what radar stood for?
My last name is Sadar, which rhymes with radar, and I didn't know. Now, Mike Opelka provided this, but so he sent this in, and I had heard it before.
Who's Michael Opelka?
Mike Opelka, I used to work with him over at the Blaze. He was my boss over there. So he sends out a daily little fun fact.
Oh, he does
thing.
This? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
terrific
so guy. Now we're going to tell our audience because they're waiting with bated breath.
Okay.
How do you spell bated breath?
B-A-T-E-D.
Correct.
Thank you.
Because it's apostrophe abated. Abated is to hold, right?
Yes.
With bated breath, our audience is waiting now to find out what is the meaning of radar. What is R-A-D-A-R? And it is this, and I had no idea. Ready? Radio detection and ranging system.
Right.
Radio detection and ranging system. Maybe the reason we don't know what it stands for is because that's kind of boring. Radio detection and ranging system, radar.
Yeah.
Robert Watson Watt, 1935, invented radar successfully.
Do you know what Kodak means? You know, Eastman Kodak? He just came up with a name that was like catchy for his camera.
Are you kidding?
Yeah, he just said Kodak sounds really cool and catchy. That's like radar sounds better than
radio. It's funny, when somebody says Kodak, I think of Kodiak as in a Kodiak bear, Kodiak, Alaska.
Right, but this was Kodak, and that was it. It was just like a neat name.
I love the idea how words are evocative.
Evocative.
In other words, even though you know what the word means, mm-hmm. right, that's called the denotation of the word.
Yep.
But the connotation is like, what does it evoke? And a word like Kodak, it evokes a number of things. I guess I think of that yellow Kodak color and maybe a picture of Alaska. That's what comes to my mind.
Yeah.
Anyway,
George
I think
Eastman,
we're losing our audience.
Okay,
we better shut up.
Let's do something
okay,
quick.
So there's a lot of stuff going on. At the end of the program, we're going to tell you about a new opportunity that we have. As you know, periodically we do these fundraisers, and we've worked with Food for the Poor in the past. We're working with them just now this month. We're going to have a goal of $40,000, which we should be able to knock that out in a day. If four people would step up
yes.
and kick in $10K, you get to have dinner with me and Albin, whoever you like, anytime. And then, of course, the rest of you, you can give what you like. But we're going to be talking about that. It's a serious opportunity. We love to do this, love to give you an opportunity to give. So when we come back, we're talking for this hour and the next hour with Dana Lash. Don't go away. It's the Eric Metaxas Show, and as usual, I have an extraordinary guest in the studio right here in New York City. You probably know her. If you don't, you will now. Her name is Dana Lash. The book is called Grace Canceled, How Outrage is Destroying Lives, Ending Debate, and Endangering Democracy. Dana, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. Beautiful studio.
Isn't it? I built it with my own hands. It's beautiful.
You did such a great job.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Eric, so good.
I color outside the lines. Listen, I know you just because I've watched you on The Blaze, and you've had a radio program for many, many years. You're known, I guess, principally as a gun rights advocate. Would I say that? That you're big on that?
That's one of the things that I do, but yeah. I think it's one of the things for which I am most known.
Right.
Because of everything that's happened and the now infamous town hall and everything else.
Wait a minute. What infamous now infamous town hall?
Oh, that one.
No. I'm not so hardcore that you can assume I know all this stuff.
The CNN town hall after Parkland. And so after that, I think people just sort of.
You were involved in that.
Oh, yeah. I was on stage with that.
I missed it.
Yeah.
Albin. You didn't prep me. No, seriously, now that you mention it, I do remember, but I wasn't. Tell us a little bit about that, because some people like me, maybe they saw it or they saw a clip.
Yeah, yeah. No, and that was actually one of the things that sort of factored into why I wrote this book. And I have a chapter on that specifically when I discuss the media's role in kind of fomenting all of this outrage culture, this cancel culture. Because I've done radio since 2008. I've done politics and written about politics for even longer. But the main thing, I guess, that I am known for is Second Amendment advocacy, and I do passionately believe in it. And you know,
Are you packing now?
Well, I'm in New York, and I'm in New York for longer than 24 hours.
Oh, so you can't be.
Yeah, your state, Eric.
It's not my state. Whoa.
Your state, Eric.
It ain't my state.
But
I live here.
It is. Well, see, and I would only do that to come here to talk to you.
There's no way.
Otherwise, there's no way. But no. And so I guess Second Amendment advocacy is that's when people think of it, they typically, my face, I guess, kind of floats in their head because I've been so vocal about it.
Yeah.
And I'm so passionate about it. And it's one of those things that you kind of, you develop a passion for it if you like freedom and liberty. But then there's another level if you've actually had to rely on it for more than hunting. And that kind of factors into it as well.
If you've actually had to rely on it.
If you've had to really rely upon your Second Amendment rights for self-defense. And my first book, Hands Off My Gun, I shared that story when I was very young, and my family's from southern Missouri. I had a family member who was fleeing an estranged husband who was a prohibited possessor, and he had threatened to kill her, and she ran through the woods to my grandparents' house, where I was spending the last weekend of summer with my grandparents before I went back.
How old were you?
I was probably about maybe 11, 10, 11. I was around the age of 10, 11. And it was after the 10 o'clock news, because I remember they were getting ready to watch one of the late shows, and I heard footsteps in their gravel drive, and it sounded like there was a wild animal outside. But it was my aunt. She was crying, and she had been beaten up by her estranged husband, who is now in prison still for a very long time. And my grandfather got his shotgun and had sat on the porch swing outside to defend the family, because this particular individual had quite a reputation and we knew he would follow up on it. And my aunt lived not very far from my grandparents. And so having gone through that and having that fear and then knowing that my grandfather was outside and had a firearm, I learned to normally when people go through a traumatic event or something that scares them, they come away thinking two things, particularly if it involves firearms. You either blame the inanimate object for the evil that has been caused to you,
right,
or you think, I wish I had had a gun too. And I, or I'm glad that we had a gun. And I came away grateful for the latter. And that really informed my opinion on that and pretty much shaped it for the rest of my life. And
the image of Grandpa with the gun on the porch swing, that it doesn't really get too much more American than that.
And
it?
Oh yeah, and he was a World War II vet. He was on USS Alabama, and he hunted quite frequently, and he was quite tall.
You know, I should say I'm a porch swing advocate. That's not in the Constitution yet, but we're working on it. I want to ask you, you know, before we get in the book is called Grace Canceled, How Outrage is Destroying Lives, Ending Debate, and Endangering Democracy. But I want more of your story, because a lot of people tuning in, they may know you a little bit. They saw you on a Beat commercial, or they saw you on CNN that time. I just want to kind of get your story. You've already told us you grew up in southern Missouri. So tell us about your background. You are a Christian.
Mm-hmm. I was raised Baptist.
You were raised now. Okay, now that means nothing.
Yeah, I was raised Baptist. I am non-denominational Church of Christ now.
Okay. You believe in the bodily resurrection?
Yes.
Okay, we're done here. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I didn't know, because, you know, when somebody says I'm a Christian, a lot of times people say, well, I was raised Baptist, and I think, what does that mean? It's like saying I was raised Catholic. I was raised Greek Orthodox. Like, do you believe, or are you just raised
there's
that?
There's a kind of a culture that goes along with it. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
There's a flavor. There's a culture. There's you know, some doctrinal stuff, too, that goes along with it. But it's funny because the town that my family is from, there are approximately 301 people in that town. And there are three churches for those 301 people that are in that town. Oh, yes. And it is very interesting if someone leaves one church to go to the other church.
Yeah.
Because
that's called poaching.
And especially when two of them are on the same street, and you can stand on the front steps of one church and see the other church. And it gets a little competitive down there.
Yeah,
I have to say,
that's not what we call kingdom thinking, but we're not going to get into that. So at what point, I guess I should ask, or at any point, did your faith become personal for you? Because a lot of times we're raised in certain cultures, but it's kind of just what everybody does.
Right.
Was there a point where it became real to you?
I think it always has been. My grandparents were very strong influences in my life, my mother's parents. My grandfather, this is kind of funny, he hated banks. And he would not put his money in a bank.
Is this the one with the shotgun on the porch?
This is a shotgun grandpa.
He hated banks.
And didn't like banks. And so he kept a big Bible on their coffee table. And he put all of his important documentation and money in the Bible on the coffee table, where they didn't have a lock on their front door, and everybody was always in and out of their house. I mean, they had 23 grandchildren. We had a huge family. And he would put, like, some of the papers he would put in there were the vaccination certificates for his hunting dogs. He had all of that in there. And I remember asking him one time as I got older, and I realized, you actually have a significant amount of money in this Bible. Why are you not putting that anyplace safer? And he said, well, no heathen's going to open this. And
oh, that's funny. Now that's so funny.
And I have that Bible. After they passed, I got that Bible in my office.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Do you have the combination?
No, it was just a zipper, leather.
Oh,
it was
right.
One of them big Bibles with the little gold leather zipper.
Oh my! I'm glad, as long as there was something.
Nobody took anything out of that Bible, and he was right. He's like, no heathen's going to open this.
That is funny. That is funny. Okay, so you grew up in a strong Christian background. You've been married for what, 20 years?
19 years.
19 years.
Yeah, we got married young.
To the guy that I met with the beard and the mustache.
Yeah.
Okay. When did you get politically involved? Like, what was your path? Did you go to college for that? Did you go to school? What's your path?
So my family, they were believers, And my mother was a single mom for a good portion of my life. And I told her, I'm like, we need to start going to church. So we start, I just was like, we got to go to church.
Her.
Yeah. I was like, we're going to church. So you're going to take me and you're going to drive me to church. So we went to church, found one that was close to our house, and we got along with everybody, there were some kids from my school there. So we started going to church. And I had always been political, but this is what's funny, because everyone likes to stereotype everybody who's rural or everyone who's Republican or everyone who's Christian. My family were not Republicans. My family were Democrats. Of course, they were Union Democrats.
Right.
It's kind of a different kind. They worked in auto manufacturing. They worked in mines. That's what my family did. And so they were union voters and they supported the Democrat Party. And I was raised by Democrats. All my teachers were Democrats. All my friends were Democrats. I did not meet my very first Republican in real life until I was in seventh grade. And it was a very nice boy named Jason Winters. And he and I would argue constantly. We were on the newspaper staff for our junior high and we would argue constantly. But we were still friends.
Right.
And we got along. And then as I got older, there were certain things that I began questioning. And this was back in the day when Democrats still supported, you know, at least somewhat the Second Amendment.
This
right?
Is before this was Democrats different. Went full on
there was
socialist,
still,
communist, yeah. baby killing.
There was still some
Not
Kennedy
that there's anything
Democrat.
Wrong with that. We don't judge. But
it's wrong.
Of course we did. That was called sarcasm. I have to tell you, fact that the party has gone to where it is today, I think there are a lot of people that are still trying to figure out what happened to the party.
Yeah,
we're gonna go to a break,
but
we will be right back, and the party will continue with Dana Lash on the Erickman Taxes Show.
I got your number, if it's still the same, and you can dream.
Man, do I hate to interrupt the Bee Gees, but I have Dana Lash in the studio.
It's a good part of the song, too, right there.
Oh, my gosh. I'm talking
only
to you.
Only disco song I like.
Dana Lash, the only what?
Only disco song I like.
That one?
Mm-hmm.
Literally?
Literally. You played it.
I play a lot of Bee Gees, but I'm glad we played the particular one that you like. Now, I have to ask you some questions still, because I want to find out more about you that people aren't going to find out on these other shows. I was asking you, what is your ethnic background?
Right.
And you said?
My ancestry is American Indian, Irish, and we had a pirate in our family. Last name was Sutton, and he ended up getting hung off the coast of the Carolinas.
Now, I'm pretty sure I would never correct you unless I like you a lot. I think it's hanged.
For the rest of your life. Southern Missouri, he was done hung.
He was done. Well, that's
that
different.
Is done now,
hung
done
is grammatically
hung
correct.
Is correct.
They done hung his.
They done hung him.
Behind. Well, his. The funny thing is, you say American Indian, Irish, and pirate. Like, that's a nationality. Like, it's a nationality.
I am most intrigued by that one.
I just love the idea.
I just got to throw that out there.
Yeah,
it
pirate.
Explains a lot.
And I like pirates always have this romantic thing, and you realize, wait, they're criminals. It's kind of like saying he was a gang member, right? Like, they were going
kind
around
of,
on the high seas chopping heads off to get whatever have that they don't. Okay, so, and when do you know when your folks came to this country, the ones who weren't already here?
We have some, we have some records. There's a big debate in our family right now because someone thinks that somehow we originated from Scandinavia and then came through parts of Europe and then came through to the United States, and then we have records of a European and American Indian marriage, and then it goes from there, and then we have roll numbers of family members who were on the Trail of Tears and all of that stuff.
Whoa.
So,
Well, it sounds like you're full-blooded American.
No.
You're as American as it gets.
American. I'm 100% American.
And now you live in Dallas, so you're super American. Okay, let me ask you then. You were talking about, when you met your first Republican or whatever. When did you decide that you wanted to, do radio or write about politics? Was that something,
I never wanted to do radio. I had zero interest in broadcasting at all, zero interest in television. And I was not really writing about politics. I wanted to do fiction and do culture. And so that's what I set out to do.
Fiction and culture.
Yeah,
and what do you mean? Were you an English major? What do you mean?
Yeah, I was going into English. And yeah. I ended up switching just to major in journalism. And I liked telling people stories. Like, I loved the Joe Mitchell style of reporting. Like, Up in the Old Hotel is just one of my favorites.
How many people are getting that reference?
And
go on.
I loved reading the crazy stories that he was telling about everyone that was in his initial vicinity. And
I can't remember, who did he write for?
I want to say, I think it was maybe the New York Times. I
was going to say, wasn't it the Times?
Yeah.
Anyway, he's like an old school.
He's
they don't have these
school.
Anymore.
Like, he wrote about the Bowery days and all
right.
of that. And,
right.
The Don't Swear Man. That was one of my favorite
yeah.
shorts that he did.
Yeah.
I loved that because it was different and you got to learn about people things you would never learn. And it just showed this real interesting fabric of the country.
And it's certainly the kind of journalism no one is doing anymore.
Nobody does that.
Because there's actually no journalism being done, period. Mm. But that's another story. Okay, so you knew that you wanted to write,
right.
And so how did you get sucked in this direction?
So I started anonymously writing about politics probably about 1999 online, and I created a website, and it was just like a PHP platform, and I just switched things out and wrote about politics and culture anonymously. And
what is PHP?
It's just like a format. It's basically the best way I can put it is it was a little bit better than GeoCities.
I don't even know what that is, so forget it.
It was weird and it was bulky, but it was mine and I loved it.
Okay.
And I really enjoyed that because I could kind of dissect issues and write without any expectation of, you know, people. We did not have the outrage mob reactions like we do now back in 1999, 2000.
No.
And it wasn't until I started writing a little publicly. I had a blog for a while, and I got a column in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and I started writing about just like everyday issues. My firstborn was a baby, and I was writing about being a parent and a little Irma Bombeck style. Then right. I wrote something about having firearms in the home. And it was not even the focus of the piece I was
writing
about. You just
mentioned it.
I mentioned it. And all Hades broke loose. I mean, there was the weeping and gnashing of the teeth. People were so upset. They were writing into the paper, how dare you print this woman? Oh, my goodness. You're going to have to rip her out of your pages.
And this is
it was
St.
the most
Louis.
Well-read column, and it was an award-winning column.
Whoa.
And so then the alternative weekly that hated the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, they were owned by the Village Voice, they loved the fact that there was controversy because they competed, so they helped blow it up even more to make them look bad, and it became a big thing. So I parted with the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and I ended up doing radio interviews about this. And there was a radio station in St. Louis that asked me if I wanted to do radio, and I told them they were crazy and to not talk to me about it again.
Yeah.
And they asked for 6 months straight. And I said, no. I was not trained in broadcasting. I didn't, and this is going to be even crazier, I didn't even listen to talk radio. I liked to read. I would read political books, but I did not listen to political talk radio.
Yeah.
And I finally said, okay. And my husband told me, he's like, just try it. Try it for a week. Try it for a couple of weeks. See if you like it. So I told the radio station, I'm not going to commit to anything. I'll do, you know, a couple shows, and we'll see how it goes. So they put me on Sunday night. And it was like 8 o'clock, you know, they bolted everything down, and it was baptism by fire, and I hated it.
You hated it. Okay, that's what we call in show business a cliffhanger. Ladies and gentlemen, she hated radio. Who knows what happened next? Stick around. Too good. I apologize, folks. But I've got a talk show to do here. I'm talking to Dana Lash. Dana, you were just talking about your career and everything.
Mm.
You said you did a little bit of radio and you hated it. And
hated
then
it to death.
What happened?
I wanted to quit immediately. And I told my husband I'm quitting. And he said, why don't you stick with it? Just do a couple more shows. He's like, seriously. He's like, when are you going to get an opportunity like this? He's like, just do it. He's like, you like talking any other day of the week. Why is it different? Because you have a microphone in front of you. And I thought, because there are other people there. So I had to pretend that I was the only person in the room and not even pretend that I had an audience, which is also something you shouldn't do in talk radio.
Yeah,
I will never teach on this. I will never teach a class
right.
on this.
I'm not pretending I know how to do this either. Trust me. I just do what I do. I don't know.
But I hated it. And there was something, I don't know what it was. The election we just had the election.
This is 2000 election.
Yeah. This is, 2008. I started on my anniversary, October 28th, 2008.
Uh-huh.
And then we had the election, and then I don't know what it was. Something clicked, and it took about 4 weeks. And then I liked it enough that I said, okay, well, we'll keep doing it, but I'm not committing to anything long term.
And this was just St. Louis.
Mm-hmm. It started out in just St. Louis,
okay.
And I stayed in that Sunday night slot, and then we moved to a weeknight slot, and then we moved to midday. And then we began expanding, and we started with Indianapolis, and then we added a couple hundred affiliates. So, and this is where we are. All started with somebody who hated talk radio.
Yeah, well.
But it's fun. I mean, I am comfortable enough with it, and it feels like I'm sitting at a table with a large monitor in front of me, albeit, you know, it's 4 foot wide.
It is.
It's a gaming console. And I just talk with people and hang out, and it's fun.
And how many hours do you do a week?
3 hours a day, so 15. Well,
wow,
yeah.
That is hardcore. My goodness.
Yeah.
Okay, so, and at what point did you get involved with Glenn Beck and Blaze and all that stuff? Because that's when people have begun to see you.
Well, I had done some stuff. I was a CNN contributor before then, and I had done a lot before I met Glenn.
That's back when CNN was news.
Yeah, well, and that's when, you know, it was okay to be conservative without pretending to be a conservative and being identified as that in the lower third and then saying everything that was anti-conservative.
Rick Santorum is my friend. Actually, he's the only one. He's the only one that is genuinely, I shouldn't say the only one, but he's the only one that I can think of right now that is conservative. But look, this is a little sidebar, but let's face it. Since this president got elected, people have gone plumb loco. There's just no other way to see it. CNN was always left-leaning, but they never were over-the-cliff insane. They have become more advocacy journalism than Sean or anybody at their worst or best, and they claim to be
humbled.
Advocacy.
They were humbled, and a bunch of other people were humbled. I think there were people who got their predictions wrong. There were people who didn't understand the electorate. They didn't understand why were people liking Trump. Why did they support him? And I think they're still having a tantrum because they did not know the people enough, and that's their job to know that.
Well, that gets into a bigger conversation because that to me, that's the great arrogance is that they discounted the grandpas on the porch swing with the gun. They basically said those people either don't count or they're on their way out, and the great unwashed, that's the past, and the future is people who think like we do.
Yeah.
And the fact of the matter is they got their arses handed to them 3 years ago. But you would have thought that would have caused them to do what they said they were going to do, which is kind of, you know, recalibrate and go back. And they did absolutely the opposite. I mean, honestly, I'm just sitting here. I've never seen anything like it in our lifetimes. There's never been anything beginning to approach what has happened to CNN or any of the major news networks. They've just gone all in on crazy. And even if Trump were to, as they say, cure cancer, they would find a way to say, but he didn't get Congress's, you know, authorization or something.
He didn't get Congress's authorization for that cancer cure, so we can't count it.
And
it was Trump, so we can't like
it. And so we're starting to like cancer. They're starting to like cancer. That's what they would say.
If Trump's pro-life, then suddenly, I can't be pro-life anymore because Trump is. And his tweets invalidate him.
And they would start saying that, you know, cancer's been persecuted, and who are we to judge that it's bad? So, okay. So let me ask
you. But yeah, to your question.
You start getting on CNN. Okay.
Yeah, I was on CNN. Yep. And then I was writing for Andrew Breitbart's website.
Oh.
And I was the editor of Big Journalism. Andrew hired me. I'm trying to think when this was. He hired me. I worked on Breitbart, left after he passed away, and did a few other things. And then I ended up going to Texas to work with Glenn because I liked what he was doing. And Glenn's fun. His sets are crazy. I would walk in, and there's a giant, like, 8 foot tall stuffed bear. It was a real bear. Just right there. And
right.
then I'd come in another day, and there's the Forrest Gump bench. And then I
You
come
know what that's
in.
Called? That's called having too much money, Glenn. Give it away. Give
walked,
it away, brother.
I walked in one day, and I was looking at my phone, and I ran into a helicopter because I was doing the whole thing where you're looking down and texting, and you're not paying attention. And I literally ran into the little chopper that they had on MASH. I literally ran into it physically with myself, person. Yes. And then it was like Willy Wonka's chocolate factory without the chocolate.
Don't you
and the
think
Oompa Loompas.
It's possible that Glenn is a kleptomaniac and that he goes to places like the Smithsonian Institution, and because he's Glenn Beck, they don't notice when he slips the MASH chopper into his coat and steals it, and he's
away.
Creating an anti-Smithsonian down there in Dallas. I'm telling you,
he's like Gru
it's a theory.
From Despicable
it's
Me.
My theory. Exactly.
It.
It's my theory. All right. So you, I mean, again, there are people who can know you from all these different places. Mm. Now, what is your main gig now? It's 3 hours of radio.
Mm-hmm. I do radio, and I write books, and that's what I enjoy it. I like it.
You write books? Is this a book that you wrote?
It is. It's a book that I wrote.
You know,
wrote.
I was thinking we might be able to talk about this at some point.
It's an interesting book because it's different.
We've got plenty of time, and I want to hear everything that you have in this book. The title of it is Grace Canceled with one L because that's the American spelling.
That's what, yeah. When I first saw the mock-up, I emailed my editor, and I said, this is wrong. And I felt like I've caught you. Look at you're the editor and I caught you.
Yeah.
And he says, no, that's you're spelling it the British way. So I
right.
looked up the etymology of the word canceled and read all about the history of it. And he was right.
Oh, when we come back, we're going to talk about the etymology of the word canceled. Actually, I'm big into etymologies. Huge. We're talking to Dana Lash. We've got her for 2 hours. Do not go away.
Well, I tried to make it Sunday, but I...
Hey there, folks. Happy Ash Wednesday.
Yes.
Actually, that's a joke. You can't say happy
no.
Ash Wednesday.
I know, it's
the whole idea is that it's ashes. It's the opposite of happy. It's contrition, right? It's
it
this
is.
Idea that it's this reminder of our mortality and of what's it all about
yeah.
and where we're headed, folks.
And every year I always say on Ash Wednesday, think fast.
It's, oh, that
yeah.
was funny.
Yeah.
Albin.
Okay, let's go on.
Why do they always say you're not funny? You are funny.
A little bit.
All right. On Ash Wednesday, we thought it would be appropriate today to kick off our spring campaign to help kids and families facing malnutrition and starvation in Guatemala. Wow. I mean, again, we are so blessed mm-hmm. in this country, in the West. We are hugely blessed. And we have to realize that there are places in this world, I mean, actually, Guatemala specifically, has the highest level of malnutrition in the Western Hemisphere. And I want people to think about this concept, malnutrition. Do you know anybody suffering from malnutrition? It's the sort of thing we think doesn't exist. But in our own hemisphere, not very far from our own borders, there are people suffering from malnutrition. Well, the good news is that Food for the Poor and other organizations do tremendous work. How do they do it? Do they do it because there's a great profit incentive? No, they do it because they think it's the right thing to do. So I want to just say that Food for the Poor right now is working with us on this program. You can see a banner at our website, MetaxasTalk.com, and your donation will help the poorest of the poor in Guatemala. Actually, Food for the Poor has Representative Alice Marino. Let's play Alice.
Because you can make a difference with just so little. So little goes such a long way. And, you know, God will reward you. And you're going to feel so good about changing the life of a child. So please go online or go on the phone right now and make that difference.
Mm-hmm. We have to remind ourselves, ourselves over and over and over again that this is real, that there are people struggling to put food on the table. and this is in Guatemala, as I say, highest level of malnutrition in the Western Hemisphere, so food for the poor goes right there. They need your help. But here's the amazing thing, truly amazing. The economies of places like Guatemala are so bad that $80 American dollars can provide food for an entire year and water for life. They're drilling wells. You've seen videos of this on, you know, here and there. There are places where they have to walk miles and miles and miles for clean water. There's disease in the water. So a one-time gift of $80, think about this, folks, provides food for 1 year and water for life for a kid in Guatemala. It literally saves lives, and I don't need to tell you, preaches the gospel of Jesus Christ. Why do you think people are doing this? Mm-hmm. Because they believe in Jesus and what he says, and so that's food for the poor. So if $80 provides food for a year, $320, which is 4 times 80, provides the same blessing, obviously, for a family of four. That ends up being just $27 a month. Some people would prefer to give that way. This is a great way to remind your kids in your family of where your values are. You use this as an opportunity, and you say, we're giving $27 a month. You can require your kids to chip in from their allowances, from what little money they make, doing chores, whatever it is. I just want to say this is a great teaching opportunity, and the results are so dramatic. When you think that $320 could feed an entire family for 1 year. That is the kind of scale we're talking about. So I'm going to give you a phone number. You can go to our website again. It's metaxastalk.com. I want people to give as generously as they can. 844-863-HOPE. 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 God bless you. I don't care.